Mr. Roth, Real 9. Now, we're talking about your time in Cyprus, based at Famagusta. Now, I believe that an incident happened at Nicosia.
Yes.
If you'd like to tell us the whole background to that story, what exactly happened?
Well, what it was, there was a new officer coming out to join the regiment and was flying out and would land at the airport at Nicosia. And I was sent to meet him and bring him back. The reasoning being that if you just sent a Land Rover with a driver and something, as in the event it did happen, he would be totally inexperienced, new to the island, didn't seem like a good idea. So I go and meet him, and we're driving back through Nicosia to return to Famagusta. And we come in one side of this square, and unbeknown to me, some kind of demonstration was taking place and escalating very rapidly. And I suddenly find myself in the middle of the square in this Land Rover with the driver and this new officer in the back. And it was very apparent to me, and I can't remember now what the background, but it was very apparent to me that a seriously riotous situation was building up, and I'm in the middle of it. I have a pistol, but that's it, you know. And so I said to the driver, I said, go for it. I said, get out of this square, go for it. And he did just that, and he sort of basically starts driving at the people, and they all jump out of the way. And we get out to the edge of the square, and we get out. The significance of that is that a few months later, a major did exactly that. His Land Rover hits and kills one of the people, and he was court-martialed. And I remember, because I was back in England by then, reading about his court-martial and thinking, well, there, but for the grace of God, go I. And he was very criticised, and I thought to myself, well, it's very easy to criticise, but you're in that situation. It seemed the fastest way out. I can't remember what happened to him. I think he was convicted, and I don't know, you know, reprimanded or whatever. But I remember reading it and thinking, oh dear, you know, I wouldn't have wanted to end my national service with a court martial.
But it was actually exactly what you'd done.
I did exactly the same as he did. Said to the driver, go for it. Get the hell out of this square and go at the crowd and on the basis that, if they, you know, they'll jump out of the way.
Now, just a point, that you were aware, and I presume this other officer would be aware, of the absolute futility of drawing your gun. Pistol.
Oh, yes. I mean, one has to understand, at Cyprus at that time, shooting anybody was the last thing in your mind. I mean, the next stage, which we would have done in Trichomo, if the balance had been more even, we might well have started using tear gas. But you needed to have a lot of support. If you start dispersing with tear gas, you need to have then lots and lots of soldiers to follow up as they're dispersing, if you see what I mean. Just got to keep on chasing them until you dilute the crowd more and more. But yeah, actually shooting somebody, I never got within light years of even thinking about shooting some poor beggar.
So any other instance, or what's the thing that happens next?
Well, I think probably what you would be quite interested in is the firing camp. Because for 3 weeks we revert to being an artillery regiment.
Now, where was the firing camp at again?
The range area was on the plains between Nicosia and a town called Lefkonica. And you have the main road, and the ranges were north of that main road, going up into the foothills of the Kyrenia Mountains. And we did the firing camp as batteries. We couldn't go out as a regiment because we still had quite a lot of internal security duties and responsibilities. But we did a firing camp at the battery, and for 6 days did some proper gunnery.
And what do you remember of that?
Well, for a start, it was the first firing camp that had taken place in Cyprus for about 4 years. So there was lots of ammunition. There was a lot of ammunition available, so we were able to seriously bang off guns. By that I mean that when you're doing a firing camp, you range your target with a single gun. I think I explained that at an earlier stage. When you'd ranged onto the target, then you would get an order of one round gunfire, and all eight guns would fire, but just one round, obviously because of the economy. But we were able to do a proper sort of five rounds gunfire, so you had all the guns banging off five rounds each. So you sent off 40 shells, and we were a very successful battery. We had a brilliant firing camp, mainly because we had three top flight troop sergeant majors. The battery sergeant major was a man called Davidson, who really, really was good. Not a typical sergeant major, and sort of big, shouting, much more intelligent, much more technically skilled, basically very able man. The two troop sergeant majors were much more sort of fighting mind Goddard that I've talked about, and the other one was a man called McNulty, who came from the Royal Artillery, mainly because although he was a deeply effective warrant officer, he did like the sauce a bit, and every so often would get a little out of control, and the horse artillery wouldn't have that, so he came to us. But they were three first-class sergeant majors, and our battery, our firing week went like clockwork, and we were, you know, doing the fire and movement by leaving one troop in position, firing the other troop, moving to a new position, ranging in, and so forth, and it all went like clockwork, and we had an absolutely first-class week. In total contrast to 7-9 battery, who go out the next week, and whose whole week is just a series of disasters, and they had as bad a week as we had a good.
Now, how did you manage? Because your only previous experience seems to have been the firing camp you'd had in Wales, as far as I can tell.
Absolutely.
Were you able to cope, or did you just leave it to your...
I relied very heavily on the sergeant major. I also had a very good technical assistant, who was a sergeant called Owen, and he was quite young, but he was also very, very skilled. And I really relied on them. I mean, I knew roughly what I was trying to do. But of course, we were operating as a battery, so a lot of it was not being done by me, but being done by the command post officer, who was the lieutenant I mentioned, Peter Gill. And he was the command. He's the command post officer.
So what exactly were you? You were.
I was in charge of the gun position of Bravo troop.
Yes, your gun position.
Yeah, I was the gun position officer. But we are operating as a battery, so all the firing instructions and everything are all really coming from the CPO, the command post officer, as a battery. So I'm only really there standing, just sort of monitoring really what's going on. But we did have it was very successful, and because we were the first guns to have fired in Cyprus for about 4 years, I gather that up at the command post, the colonel was holding court, and every general and brigadier in the island practically was turning up and having his little go and pooping off and doing his sort of command post officer trick. And as I say, we had a very good camp. And poor old 7-9 had a very bad one. And then the third battery, my wand, 145 battery, they had quite a good firing camp. But I remember the 7-9, and of course one of the fascinating things there was that the major who commanded 7-9 battery, oh God, what was his name? Marchant. Major Marchant. And the thing was that the colonel was having an affair with his wife, which the whole officers' mess were aware of, because the colonel hadn't brought his family out to Cyprus, and he had been living in the mess, which was uncomfortable. And then he sends old Marchant and his battery off up to Bogaz, and he more or less moved in with Mrs. Marchant, so we didn't see much of the colonel, and we were all deeply grateful to Mrs. Marchant, because this is the new colonel, and he was a disaster.
Well, tell me about it. Do you remember his name? Or
Froude.
Froude?
Froude, F-R-O-U-D. And he arrived, and it, within 3 months, he basically destroyed the regiment.
In what way? How? I mean, it can't have helped having an affair with one of his senior officers, I presume.
Well, that, yes, but that was fringe to it. He it's very difficult to explain, and curiously enough, I saw exactly the same thing happen some years later with the Isle of Wight Division of Police when a new chief superintendent came, when I was a prosecuting solicitor. And exactly the same thing, bullying his junior, you know, bullying his battery commanders. Very difficult to sort of state it with precision, but basically he undermined morale disintegrated, unfair decisions, suddenly all the senior warrant officers are suddenly putting in for transfers, the whole thing just went to pieces. And it was really quite dismaying because we, you know, it had been a very good regiment. Then we get a new battery commander because Charlie Porter becomes 2IC. He becomes the senior major, so he becomes 2IC of the regiment and moves into regimental headquarters. And we get a new major. Now, I was only there for about another fortnight. But I could see that he was going to be a Froude, but at battery level.
Do you know his name?
No, I don't. No. I don't remember that. And within a fortnight, my father dies of a coronary, and I come home. And
before we go, because we're obviously going to Hawaii, because you came home early.
Yeah.
Is there anything else, any other incidents you recall, military incidents, and then while you were out there, or was that?
I think I've given you the main ones, the Oki Day, which was a pretty hairy business.
When you went out, did you go out much into Famagusta or?
No, we didn't. The first months we were there, you were basically confined to camp, and the only, if you went out in the evening, the only thing you could do would be to go down to a married quarter if you were invited down to sort of supper by one of the married officers down in the town.
So it wasn't a question of going to a bar or
pictures,
or anything?
None at all. No, didn't do that first to last.
So you wouldn't have much contact with the Greeks or Turks at all, really?
No.
Now, what about this incident with the Turks where a couple of them got shot and then you fell out with the Turks as well?
Well, I can claim to be, I was 60 miles away up the panhandle when that happened.
That was during your first battery detachment or the second?
No, I think this was when we had, as a battery, we were now at Arcrades.
We haven't covered that a bit, so tell me about that you were detached again to another battery camp.
Yes, we did our first stint at Bogaz and go back to Famagusta. Then, before we would have by rotation gone back to Bogaz, they rejigged the areas that regiments were responsible for, and we took in the whole of the panhandle now, and consequently we had two battery camps. We had the one at Bogaz and we had another one at this place called Arcrades, which was just outside a town, the name of which at the moment does not come back to me.
All right. What was it like?
This way, same again. Basically tented camp. Let me tell you very briefly about Christmas, because this was quite interesting. We, because we were at Acrades for Christmas, and the orders came from Nicosia that Christmas Day and Boxing Day were to be normal patrolling days. And Charlie Porter, our battery commander, said to hell with that. He said, I don't see why we shouldn't have ourselves a half-decent Christmas. And he went into, God, Yalusa, the name of the town, Yalusa, spelt something like Y-A-Y-A-Lusa, L-O-U-S-A. So I think that's it. And he went in and he saw the heads of the Turkish and the Greek communities, the Moktas. And he said, if I guarantee you don't see a soldier on the 25th and the 26th of December, will you guarantee me that nothing untoward will happen in our area? And they said yes. So when this order came out for normal patrol activities on Christmas Day, he sold it by saying to two of them, I can't remember now, sort of Donald, Land Rover, go 1 mile down the road, turn around, come straight back in. David, you take the ferret scout car, go 1 mile down the other way, turn around, come straight back in, and put in full patrol reports, which is what we did. And we locked ourselves up in the camp for 48 hours and had ourselves a whale of a Christmas. But the fascinating thing about it is this. At midnight on Boxing Night, the party has moved round. This is the officers. And we are now in the bombardier's mess. And you've got all the officers and all the sergeant major, the sergeant majors, the sergeants and the bombardiers. And we're all reasonably well sloshed, you know. We've had ourselves a very good Christmas. And at 5 minutes after midnight, they shoot a Turkish policeman and kill him in Riza Karpasa, which is the town at the end of the panhandle. And the report comes through, you see a policeman shot dead, and everybody slightly sobers up. And, of course, who's on duty from midnight but Second Lieutenant J.H. Roth, R.A.? And 5 minutes later, I'm sitting on the top of the ferret scout car being driven by a fairly drunk Lance Bombardier at about 90 miles an hour up the road to Riza Karpasa, where, you know, where there's one dead Turkish policeman. And so they kept the bargain, but within 10 minutes of the end of the bargain period, they shoot the policeman.
That was on the 27th.
That was on the, yeah, just after midnight on the 27th. And I remember, because it was the first time that I basically sobered up without ever going to sleep, which is a fairly uncomfortable experience. But that was, I can't think of anything else.
The two Turks that were shot by the British, you don't know. Do you know the circumstances, or
no,
is it
all
very
I know
much
is
hearsay?
All I know is that there was a lot of trouble building up in Famagusta, and of course Famagusta was really two cities. You had the old walled city, which was the Turkish quarter, and then the Greek part of it, which was outside the ancient walled city and was called Varosha. Varosha, and there was all kinds of troubles building up in the Turkish quarter, and I've no idea what it was all about. The net result was is that our regiment go in and succeed in shooting and killing two Turks, and of course that seriously stirred things up and tended to start to turn the Turkish population against the British.
It seems remarkable. I mean, all the stories about Greek trouble seem to end with nobody being shot.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And then this seems particularly tactless to the only time the Turks cause any
trouble. Oh, I see what you mean, yes. Yes.
The only time the Turks cause any trouble, they end up dead, or some of them.
Yes, absolutely. But I know nothing about it, as I say, because I was 60 miles up the road in the panhandle. And all simply heard it sort of coming over the radio.
And it was noticeable, the effect on the Turks.
Oh yes, it began to subtly start to change, And of course, I think by now, of course, the political negotiating where they were working towards some kind of a political settlement. And of course, as we all know, you know, the subsequent troubles, and now Cyprus is divided into the Greek and the Turkish. And I think now the Turks, I may be wrong about this, but I think the Turks were beginning to think, beginning to get the feeling that the Brits were going to sell them out, having loyally supported them. I think they must have felt that it was getting near to, and they were going to be sold down the road. Which, of course, to some extent, of course, they thought they were when, you know, the eventual political settlement came about.
Now, what about the circumstances of your leaving? Because they were unfortunate.
Yes, my father dies as a coroner.
Now, was this in any way expected? I mean, were you aware he was ill?
No. I was expecting it to be my mother who died, who was a diabetic, had dreadful heart, all the kind of allied things that go with diabetes. But my father was pretty hale and hearty. I mean, I gather he had a busy day on the day that he died. He goes home, went to bed, woke up feeling... turned to my mother and said, oh dear, I do feel the most strange. And basically curled up his toes and died.
So what did they do? What happened? Because you were brought home. Now that's...
No, I wasn't brought home, you see, because he was dead. If he'd been seriously ill, the army would have flown me back at top speed to his bedside. Because he was dead... they wouldn't send you home. But I had a lot of leave due to me, and indeed, in fact, I was due in the not-too-distant future to go off with three pals for a week's leave in Beirut. And I had a lot of leave due to me, so I went to the colonel and said, look, could I have UK leave? And he said, yes, if you pay your own fare. But he said, I'll certainly agree you can go have UK leave. So that's what I did, and I bought my own air ticket and flew home. And then when I got home, there was tremendous problems, which sort of great family difficulties, because of course both my brothers were married, had their own homes. My sister was worked for BEA. She was an air hostess in BEA, so she was away from home. My mother was in a terrible state because she had poor health. But also, the family affairs were in a fair old muddle as well. So I went to the War Office and I said, look, I've only got about, what did I have, February? I've only got about 14, 15 weeks to do. What are the chances of a UK posting? And the fellow was very good, and he went through it, and he said, how about ATS Light ACAC, Albany Barracks, Newport, Isle of Wight? And I said, thank you very much.
Which, of course, is effectively your home.
Yeah, just up, literally up the road. And not a barracks any longer, it's a prison now. And the colonel allowed me to live at home, because I went in and I said, look, you know, my mother's really very unwell in that, and he gave me, and so I basically lived at home for the next 10 or 11 weeks. And then the last 4 weeks, I did a civil defence course.
Now, while you were with the 8, did you have any duties with them?
Yes, he put me in charge of the sergeant mess account and the Royal Artillery Yacht Club's two yachts. St. Barbara and Blue Thrush, which were actually in Groves and Guthrie's yard at the time because it was still winter. And he said, well, you know, look after the yachts and run the sergeant's mess account and...
Some minimal duties.
Yeah.
Were able to... What proportion of your time were you able to devote to the family affairs?
Well, quite a lot. I mean, what I used to do, I used to go in and report in the morning and go on sort of battery parade in the morning. Then I used to go and do whatever was necessary for the sergeant's mess account, you know, really getting the money and so forth. And then having done all that, I used to say, right, well, I'm now going down to Groves and Guthrie, you know, to check out how the boats are doing and disappear for the rest of the day.
And would you check them?
Oh, I'd pop in, you know, and the two lads would be sanding down the, you know, and that, and I'd say, okay, lads, you know, and I'd go off then, go home. And, you know, got on with the rest of my life, so to speak. So but they did send me then the last 4 weeks.
So that was from February to May?
Yes, because the last 4 weeks I did a civil defence course in Epsom. Have you ever heard of a thing called a mobile defence column? Aha. Well, I'm about to educate you. When you had completed your 2 years national service with the colours, you then, of course, had to go in so many years in the TA. But in fact, a whole lot of us were not put into the TA. We were put into a thing called the Mobile Defence Corps. And what this was, it was a nuclear nuclear war scenario. And basically speaking, what it was, we had a muster point, and for me, it was the middle of Salisbury Plain. And the theory was that if a nuclear war broke out, you immediately reported to your muster point. They all chucked their nukes at each other, and when that was over, you then went in and rescued as many people as you could. I thought the whole thing was totally daft, but it was not very popular. When
so
I said
you were
that.
Trained. So what form did the training on this civil defence course take?
Basic firefighting, basic first aid, searching rubble, you know, searching bombed buildings for bodies. Yes, so first aid, some basic firefighting, searching buildings, and a few other things which don't immediately leap to mind. But it was a whole kind of... The idea was that, you know, they've dropped a nuclear bomb halfway between Portsmouth and Southampton, and the cities of Portsmouth and Southampton are gone. But as you went further and further away from ground zero, there would be more and more people who needed to be helped. And the idea was is that you would be a uniform, disciplined body with basic skills to sort of help.
So you weren't an officer, you weren't being trained as an officer, you're just one of a body of...
Oh, no, you'd still be an officer, you'd be a second lieutenant.
So how many would there be in this?
Oh, several hundreds. You're going to be sort of kind of battalion strength. I mean, we never mustered. Never ever again. I mean, I was demobbed out of the training place at Epsom, and that was the end of it. Never went near a uniform in any shape or form again.
So there were just plans for a mobile defence corps,
yeah.
But you never practised it. You just had this one month training.
You did the 1 month training, and I think the whole structure was in place. I mean, you know, presumably there was a commanding officer and a 2IC, and I can't remember now.